This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Germany and Ecuador are through, as are England and, most spectacularly, Argentina, which discombobulated the entire soccer universe yesterday by scoring six times against Serbia-Montenegro. Poland and Costa Rica are playing out the string. France and Sweden are still trying to find themselves. And I'd better stop now or I'll have nothing to talk about with Sports Illustrated's Grant Wall, who joins me now from Hamburg, Germany, one of the cities where the World Cup is in progress. Grant, welcome to Only a Game.
Good to be with you, Bill.
We've seen reports of German and Polish hooligans, but has the mood there generally been celebratory?
More so than you could imagine. It's really a festive occasion. I haven't been around any of the few incidents that have taken place, but the general interaction between fans from all over the world is just really positive. It's a lot of fun. People are having a good time.
Let's talk about Ecuador, through with 6 points, having beaten Poland and Costa Rica. Ecuador has never been in the second round before. Can they go even further?
Well, this is only their second World Cup, and I think they can go further, potentially. They certainly think they can, because they told me yesterday after the game, I said, we dream of winning the championship. They could end up playing England, though, in the second round, which would be an awfully tough matchup for the Ecuadorians, who have already played extremely well here, and England hasn't yet, but you get the sense that England could go off at any moment.
Brazil, the favorite before the tournament began, played just well enough to beat Croatia on Tuesday. Should fans of Brazil be worried?
Well, they should be concerned about a few things, that Croatia had a lot of chances and could have gotten a tie or even a win out of that game, and the fact that Ronaldo is really overweight. It's been a real problem in the lead-up to the World Cup. He's been carrying about 20 more pounds than he had at the last World Cup, and yet he still had a starting spot waiting for him here. I wrote a column saying I think he should probably be benched, and that may happen very soon.
Here in the U.S., there was considerable disappointment when the Czech Republic rolled over Landon Donovan and his highly touted teammates. Should we have expected that result?
Well, I don't think anyone expected the effort level and the timid nature of the American team out there against the Czechs. This was a team that had talked big about being able to compete with anyone in the world, and they were really humbled from minute one in that game. And so that's the most surprising thing. Obviously, a 3-0 scoreline never looks good. It's embarrassing. It's humiliating. And so, yeah, I was very surprised. I think anyone would be.
How hard is it to make the transition from humbled to playing brilliantly against Italy, which is, of course, what they'll have to do today?
Well, it's asking a lot of them. Over the last few days, this is a team that has been under lockdown, hasn't really been meeting with the media very much at all. There's a lot of pressure because this is basically a must-win game against Italy, and Italy looked very good in their opening match, which was a win over Ghana. And it's tough for the U.S. to start off with games against the Czech Republic and Italy, two of the best teams in the world.
Grant, just for the sake of people who are not real familiar with the way the World Cup works, technically the U.S. could win against Italy and against Ghana and still not go through.
Possible, because in your four-team group, you play three games against the other teams, and the top two teams will advance. And it's possible for three teams to get 6 points in the group if they win all their games but one. It could come down to goal differential, whether that scenario happens or not. And for the U.S., they have a really bad goal differential of -3 heading into this second game.
Germany, England, Argentina, and the Netherlands, as I mentioned, are among the teams that are through to the second round of the tournament. Is there any advantage to having that settled relatively early as opposed to needing a result in your third game?
Well, it certainly takes the pressure off. They still have some incentive to do well in their third group game because it will impact where they finish in the group, first or second, and who they end up playing in the second round once the knockout round starts. But it does allow some injuries maybe to heal up. You don't have to play all of your best players. If you're accumulating yellow cards in this tournament, if you get two, you have to be suspended for the next game. So players who are carrying a yellow card may not play in this third game.
Spain opened very well, scoring 4 unanswered goals against Ukraine. Can fans of Spain finally look forward to a glorious World Cup performance after such a history of disappointments?
Spain has looked good early in the tournament before, and then they always go on to just spit the bit. And it's something that just seems to happen every time. They end up playing poorly, or they choke, or the referees give them trouble like they did last time when they probably should have gotten to the semifinals and lost in the quarters to South Korea. It's something that confounds anyone who follows soccer. Why Spain, which has probably the best league in the world, has never won the World Cup or even really come close.
Portugal, Spain's near neighbor, scored only one goal in their opening game, but I thought they looked terrific. I thought they moved the ball around really well. Is this a team maybe that plays a little bit better as the tournament goes on each game?
Probably, and they certainly got off to a better start this time around than last time when they lost to the U.S. in the first game. Luis Figo is their best player. He has been for years, and he still has something left in the tank, even though he's well north of 30 now. If he can keep fit and have energy for the rest of the tournament, that's a team that could go really far.
Based on goals scored to this point, it's very hard to pick against Argentina as the winner of the tournament. But based on history, it's very hard to pick anybody but Brazil to finish on top. What's your best guess at this point, Grant?
Well, I went with Brazil before the tournament started. I'm going to stick with my pick, but it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see that Argentina has played the best soccer of any team in this tournament so far. They are so much fun to watch, and they really understand timing. It's almost like they have these set plays that aren't set, where they know where each other is going to be, and they can really find each other with the ball in the goal mouth, and they've scored some great goals so far. Getting six goals against Serbia was amazing.
Grant Wall covers soccer for Sports Illustrated. He joined me from Hamburg. Grant, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
The World Cup can inspire in fans a certain sense of togetherness, however fractious and fleeting. For some migrant farmers currently in Michigan, soccer has become a way for workers to come together and create a temporary sense of community. Adam Allington reports from Traverse City.
Few sports feed national pride more than World Cup soccer.
Mexico! Mexico! Mexico!
You're a big Mexico fan, huh? Why Mexico?
Because me and him are cousins. We're all cousins and we're from Mexico.
The fact that these 5- and 6-year-old kids even know about the World Cup says something about the role of soccer in their lives. But they're not watching Mexico versus Paraguay. They're watching family and friends compete in Michigan's only Hispanic soccer league. Each week, roughly 150 players and fans make the trip to Traverse City for a day of soccer, Mexican style. Fans cheer their team from bleachers or beach chairs. The sound of Tejano music blasts out of pickup trucks. People sell tacos, tamales, and soda off of their tailgates. While the atmosphere is considerably more relaxed than a typical World Cup match, many fans carry a different kind of loyalty.
The wives, they got really upset if somebody touched the husband, and they scream. They don't care. They scream. They lose control, and sometimes they say a lot of things, you know, then can offend you even to the referee.
Miguel Osorio owns a Mexican grocery store in Traverse City. He got the idea to form a migrant soccer league in 2002.
Because they're coming from big cities, and they said, why you don't organize any football tournament or something? And I said, are you really, how many players do you have? He said, I have the whole team. And, you know, people from Santos Bay, the ones that work on those fields, in Cadillac, in Lake City, in all that area. And I said, okay, put a team together, and I challenge you with my team. I will put some people together from Traverse City.
Approximately 15,000 Mexican farm workers work in northwest Michigan, harvesting mostly cherries and apples. There are 6 teams in the soccer league. After cherry season, that number could climb up to 8. Johnny Calderon plays on one of those teams, named after a hallowed English Premier League club.
One of our favorite teams is the Arsenal team from England, so we just come here and have fun. I mean, it's pretty competitive for being, you know, adult men that work, you know, overtime during the week and just come here and have fun on their day off. Most of these guys are pretty much working 50 or 60 hours a week. So, I mean, that pretty much tells you, you know, passion about the sport.
But the soccer league is not for Hispanics only. David Johnson is one of a handful of Anglos who also play. He says that short of actually going to Mexico, he would never have the chance to experience this much Mexican culture.
It's really true. Like, when I'm out there and they're speaking Spanish, I feel like I could say that I went to Mexico today just by the words I'm hearing. And compared to playing with, like, other Americans, these guys kick butt.
Large gatherings like the soccer league are rare in northern Michigan. For one, people work a lot, sometimes 7 days a week during harvest. Another reason is because some of the players are undocumented. Border patrol cars are sometimes seen parked outside of grocery stores, churches, and movie theaters. Jessica Gonzalez and her friend are selling tamales. They say people are often too scared to come out.
They don't get together because when you have a large group of Mexicans together, then the cops catch them and then they go to jail. And they get, what's that one word they go back to Mexico?
Deported?
Yeah, that one.
They get deported.
Despite the risk of deportation, people still show up every Sunday to watch and play soccer. And judging from all the smiles and cheers, most wouldn't miss it. Again, Miguel Osorio.
The Spanish people who come and work on the farms, thanks to them, we have nice, delicious cherries or wines on our table. I think it's hard work, but we love to do that. And so I think we deserve some respect. And it looks like we're getting more support every year. So here in Traverse City, now then when we're together and we found a good amount of people who likes to do sports, and when we're there on the fields, we reminds us like when we were little in Mexico.
For Only a Game, I'm Adam Allington in Michigan.
You can take a closer listen to this week's stories, find a link to our weekly podcasts, peruse our archives, or sign up for our newsletter by visiting our website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, sports writer Ira Burko confesses to a crime. But first, Game 6 of the Stanley Cup Finals takes place tonight in Edmonton, where the surging Oilers hope to draw even with the Carolina Hurricanes. Tomorrow in Miami, the Heat look to go up 3-2 over the slumping Dallas Mavericks in the NBA Finals. The battle between Dallas and Miami for the championship is not the only postseason exhibition of interest to basketball fans. The Orlando Magic's Grant Hill, the oft-injured star forward who had 4 of his last 5 seasons cut short by injuries, is trying to make a comeback. But regardless of whether Hill ever plays again, he's distinguishing himself in another arena, as Ron Schachter reports from Durham, North Carolina.
From a wall in Duke University's new Nasher Museum of Art, a three-headed black man with 3 sets of powerful arms and hands stares intently in multiple directions. The painting, called Confrontation, by African-American artist Arthello Beck Jr., belongs to Grant Hill, a serious student of African-American history and a formidable NBA forward with a lifetime scoring average of better than 15 points. Hill's collection, which focuses on 20th-century African-American artists, has grown to about 300 pieces. Over the past 3 years, part of it has traveled to 7 museums around the country in an exhibit called Something All Our Own. Hill recalls that his first artistic acquisition in college didn't stray far from home court, where he was an All-American for Duke.
The first piece I bought was, ironically, a print by an African-American artist from Durham who had done a piece called Duke Fast Break, and it pretty much showed the Duke basketball team and the All-American on that team, Johnny Dawkins, in a fast break in Cameron Indoor Stadium against North Carolina. You know, it was a print. I was able to purchase it with my limited budget at that time, but it really, kick-started this whole thing.
When the Detroit Pistons drafted Hill as the 3rd overall pick in 1994, his budget grew and his tastes progressed to artists from the Harlem Renaissance, and in particular the works of Romare Bearden and Elizabeth Catlett. Kim Rorschach is the director of Duke's Nasher Museum and leads the way to more than a dozen works of Bearden, whom she calls one of the most important 20th century artists.
This is called Cotton Field Basket Woman, and it's a landscape of people working in cotton fields, and it's made with his incredible collage technique where he takes bits out of magazines, newspapers, you know, photographs of cotton, photographs of people working, but really layering different images to come up with what becomes his composite image.
Hill says that his even larger number of Elizabeth Catlett portraits, sculptures, and narrative paintings of black women has an added significance.
I think the thing that Catlett has done a wonderful job of is she shows the strength and the beauty of the African-American female. And I know in my family there was nothing but strong women. My mother, my grandmothers, my great-grandmother, they had dynamic personalities. And, you know, in general, I think women throughout African-American history have been the consistent backbone through some really difficult times.
Hill also points to the influence of his famous father, Calvin, who starred as a running back for Yale and then for the Dallas Cowboys 30 years ago, and is himself a prolific collector of Third World art. Grant singles out a colorful piece called The Coffee Break by contemporary painter John Coleman, which depicts an older man calmly facing a younger one over coffee at the kitchen table.
Well, the coffee break scene was just another one that, you know, I liked because of the relationship I have with my father. And even now, as an adult, whether it's about my profession, whether it's about art, whether it's about parenthood, whatever it may be, having that relationship, having the opportunity to be able to sit down, you know, with my dad and to really just listen to him and learn from him.
Calvin says that the exhibit has created an unusual opportunity.
He wants young people to know, you know, who these artists are, and especially young inner-city kids, black kids, to know that there was somebody named Elizabeth Catlett or there was a guy named Romare Bearden who were very, very creative, as creative as Dwayne Wade is when he's driving to the basket. And you can do this, you know? You can be like Bearden. You can be like Elizabeth Catlett.
According to Grant, the museums displaying his collection all have reported an upsurge in younger visitors. At the Nasher Museum, Faye Cobb Payton has brought along her daughter and son.
What strikes me about the collection is the strength of the people in all walks of life, positive images of African-American people, and the importance of family is what I'm picking up.
While mother and daughter prefer the works of Catlett, son Gerald takes us back to Confrontation, that three-headed painting, with an interpretation of his own.
It looks like that there are three different sides of one person, and that the guy is angry and he has both his two good sides holding him back.
He also says he's discovered another side of a basketball idol.
I never really knew that he would collect so many paintings.
Did he do a good job?
Yes, he did.
But Hill says he's aiming to reach beyond the people viewing the exhibit.
A lot of athletes have interests that are sort of outside the box, and hopefully by me, you know, sharing this, not only will it sort of help the artist, but hopefully it'll show these other colleagues of mine that it's okay to, you know, to talk about and to share some of your other either talents or gifts, passions that are sort of outside of the norm.
Hill adds that he's not ready to become a full-time art collector. At 33, he's planning on coming back next season and would like to play 4 or 5 more years in the NBA.
I love the game, I love to play, and you know, I'm going to do all I can to try to get healthy and get out there and continue my career. And I still believe that I can continue to play and be healthy. And when I walk away from it and when, you know, I look back at it 20 years from now, you want to say, hey, I did all I could.
The exhibit, Something All Our Own, runs through mid-July at Duke's Nasher Museum. Whether Grant Hill, the basketball player, is ready to return next season should become clearer later in the summer. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Durham, North Carolina.
At one particularly revealing point in Full Swing, his most recent book, New York Times sports columnist Ira Burko acknowledges that he has sometimes had second thoughts about spending his life writing stories about games and the people who play them. Doubts visited him as he was watching his cousin, an attorney, defend 2 men unjustly convicted of rape and armed robbery. While I was writing Sports, Burko finds himself thinking he was dealing with the most monumental and noble of issues, a man's freedom. Ira Burko joins me now from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago, and maybe he'll tell us how he managed to return to the typewriter after that day in court. Ira, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, nice to be with you, Bill. Thank you.
So, did you decide that people who write about sports also get to deal with, quote, monumental and noble issues, or did you just elect to leave those issues to the lawyers?
Well, I've decided that in sports there are monumental issues as well, and issues of great importance. Mm-hmm. And one thing is constitutional rights. I remember Tanya Harding, that she shouldn't be allowed to go to the Olympics because she was involved in the knee capping of her major rival, Nancy Kerrigan.
Right.
My feeling is that she only had 3 weeks to go to the Olympics. She was saying she was innocent, and just because the circumstances seemed to convict her, I felt it wasn't enough. And I was on Face the Nation. I was on all kinds of television shows and radio shows. And eventually, within a week or so, a federal judge in Washington State agreed with me. So there are crucial things in sports. And so that's how I justify and rationalize my existence.
One story from your childhood informs your career as a sports writer, or at least your conscience. This one involves a ball player, Hank Sauer.
Yeah, Hank Sauer in 1952 was the star of the Chicago Cubs. I was living on the west side of Chicago, and my friends and I would sneak into Wrigley Field and Comiskey Park regularly. And sometimes we'd go very early and get in there with the vendors. That was a good way of sneaking in. Uh-huh. And sometimes we'd meander down and nobody was in the park and we'd go into the dugout. And this one day, Hank Sauer was shagging flies in the outfield and he came in to take batting practice. And he threw his glove on the dugout bench right next to where I was sitting and with my friend. I was 12 years old. My friend was 14. And I picked up the glove just to feel a major league player's baseball glove. Oh, my God, this was really exciting. And my friend said, let me see the glove, Ira. I said, okay, let him see it. And he took the glove and put it under his sweater and started running out of the dugout. I said, where are you going? It's Hank Sauer's glove. And he said, I'm getting out of here. And, well, that was sort of the kind of neighborhood I was from. But I couldn't imagine stealing Hank Sauer's glove. From that point forward, I always wanted to tell Hank Sauer what had happened. There was this guilt weighing heavily on my chest. And 37 years later, it was at the World Series in 1989. And so now there is the earthquake in Candlestick Park, 1989, the World Series. And everybody is leaving the park. And who comes walking toward the ramp that I'm about to go down and he's about to go down? But without question, it was Hank Sauer. I mean, you could just tell that craggy face. And so I said, Mr. Sauer. And he looked at me, and in the middle of the earthquake, and he's thinking, I want an autograph. And I said, I have something important to tell you. Can I talk to you over on the side? And people are leaving the ballpark in the middle of the earthquake. Right? And I said, well, you remember 1952? He said, well, of course, that was my MVP season. And he led the league in home runs. And I said, you lost your glove, if you recall. Your glove disappeared. And he said, that's right. And I introduced myself as Ira Burko with the New York Times. And I said to him, well, I know what happened to your baseball glove. And he said, what happened? I said, well, you came in for shagging flies in the outfield. You threw your glove in the dugout. My friend and I, he took the glove. He put it under his sweater. We ran out. And Hank Sauer was a very big guy with very big hands. And he put his hands around my throat. And he said, you stole my glove. I said, no, I didn't do it. My friend did it. But I can't give up his name, even 37 years later. And then he smiled at me, and he took his hands away, and he said, look, he says, I'm happy you finally got it off your chest.
One of the benefits of your career is that you have been in the presence of genius, at least as you have defined that term. Who are the athletes who've struck you as possessing genius?
Well, I'd have to say Larry Bird and Magic Johnson for two. And the genius, I mean, on the basketball court, both of them were like great chess players, like Bobby Fischer, who I also interviewed at one point. But they could see the move like three moves ahead. But even off the court, both of them did something that's really remarkable. After a game in which their team lost, they were always at their locker, and you could approach them and ask them about the loss and talk to them about that. Both of them were always there and available. When the team won, they weren't at their locker. They wanted the other players to get some ink, to get some attention in interviews on television. And so Bird and Magic disappeared for about the first 20 minutes or 30 minutes after a game when the reporters were in the locker room. And here is, in my view, a kind of genius, a brilliance on the court and a brilliance off the court.
I came away from Full Swing, which is subtitled Hits, Runs, and Errors in a Writer's Life, with real respect for your judgment, especially after I'd read the story of how you decided not to spar with Joe Frazier.
Oh, well, that was sort of easy judgment. Joe Frazier was the heavyweight champion of the world at the time, and Frazier was training in the Catskills at the Concord. And as you know, I mean, he was a devastating puncher. I mean, his left was like a wrecking ball. And I mean, I always felt that if he could punch a building, the building would collapse. But I was 29 years old, 30 years old at the time. And I thought, what an interesting experience just to get a feel of what it's like to be in the ring with the heavyweight champion. And so I went to his trainer, Durham, Yank Durham, white-haired guy. And I said, Yank, I'd like to go one round in sparring with Joe Frazier. And Yank Durham looked at me and he said, are you in shape? I said, well, yeah, I ride a bicycle around my Greenwich Village neighborhood where I live and I play some basketball. He said, have you ever boxed? And I said, well, I did growing up on the west side of Chicago. The Fillmore Police Station had a boxing ring and guys would go and we'd box. And he said, well, okay, he said, then if you get in the ring with Joe, he'll only break maybe two or three of your ribs. You see, my man, he don't know how to play. And I thought for a minute, and I said, Yank, I'm going to take a rain check on this. And I still have the rain check.
I don't know if basketball coach Bob Knight will read Full Swing, but if he does, he's not going to like it. You accuse him of being a liar.
Well, I do. I take an incident in 1981. A sophomore basketball player for Indiana, Isaiah Thomas. They win the national championship, and Isaiah is contemplating going pro after a sophomore season. And I go down to Bloomington to interview Thomas about his possible decision. And down there, I also want to speak to Knight, the coach. And Knight isn't talking to the press. He's also not talking to Isaiah. And it turns out that Knight wanted Isaiah to stay for two more years. His contention was that Isaiah would be just that much better of a player, and he could get that much more money in the NBA, which may be true. But Isaiah was going to be getting $1 million, which is what he got. He comes from a poor neighborhood on the west side of Chicago. Now, years later, Bobby Knight was on the Larry King show, and Knight was saying how he had recommended to Isaiah to leave Indiana and take the money. That is a blatant lie.
Ira Vercoe's most recent book is Full Swing, Hits, Runs, and Errors in a Writer's Life, published by Ivan R.D. He joined me from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. Ira, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill, and I appreciated those questions.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com, and Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting, available at the Implant Dentistry Center at bicon.com, bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Crouch, he of the Dickensian name, useless for 83 minutes, remembers just in time that height can be an advantage. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Game 5 of the NBA Finals takes place in Miami tomorrow. Are you as surprised and delighted as I am that it's a competitive series again?
Yeah, I think that everything was going splendidly until the first two games of the NBA Finals when it looked like Miami had decided not to play very much. But my fellow Marquette University alumnus, Dwayne Wade, has done an extraordinary job picking up the team and carrying it by himself. The fourth quarter in Game 3 was Jordan-esque in the fullest sense of the word, right up to the last play of the game. He came back with 36 points in Game 4. He's opened things up for Shaquille O'Neal. The supporting cast, especially Antoine Walker, our old pal from Boston, is starting to contribute. And when you see a game when the Miami bench outscores the Dallas bench by as much as it did in Game 4, then you know the dynamic of the series has switched because Dallas' depth was supposed to be the key to their winning the series.
Michael Jordan himself is back in the NBA, this time as Charlotte Bobcats part owner and managing member of basketball operations. Will Jordan experience the resounding success that he previously created in Washington?
Let me ask you a question. How many people do you think really care what Michael Jordan is doing now? I'm serious. He's left less of a footprint outside of basketball than any iconic figure I can think of. He's, at very least, at this point, he's back home. He's going to be working for an owner he trusts, an owner who wants him to be part of the franchise. If he's going to do anything as a basketball executive, this is the opportunity.
In World Cup action, Brazil plays Australia tomorrow, and if you're planning on attending Mass in Sao Paulo, you can stay right in your pew and see the game. Is church this much fun anywhere else?
No, I don't think so. I don't think anything is as much fun as it is in Brazil. At the 1988 Summer Olympics in Seoul, the Brazilian fans became the only people I ever saw who could party the Australian fans out of a bar.
Mm-hmm.
So this coming contest is an epic.
We'll see whether they can party anybody out of the church.
Have you adopted a team yet? Because I have adopted the Fighters of Trinidad and Tobago, if only because it is my great dream to have a game between Trinidad and Tobago and Serbia and Montenegro just for the line score.
Little can be said with certainty regarding the World Cup, but this much we know. No player from Saudi Arabia will be named Man of the Match. Why not?
Because it's sponsored by, let's face it, it's shocking enough that Budweiser is the official beer of a World Cup
being held in freaking Germany!
But now, because of their dedication to strict Islamic law, none of the Saudis can accept the Man of the Match award because it's sponsored by, wait for it, Anheuser-Busch. Maybe they're just sticking up for local German brewers, but I think it's more likely a religious objection.
I thought the Stanley Cup Finals might be over by now, Charlie, and I think the Carolina Hurricanes felt that way, too. What happened?
Edmonton came back and played a terrific game on Wednesday night, won 4-3 in overtime. They've managed to get back in the series, and most importantly, they've managed to do it without their number one goalie, but they're back in the series with the number two goalie now playing very strong and very confidently. So maybe it is a series again, and maybe I was just as wrong as you were on this one.
There is one theory that attributes the survival of the Edmonton Oilers to the strategic placement of a loony. This is a circumstance I might be able to comment on myself if I knew what a loony was.
Well, a loony is the Canadian equivalent of the dollar because it literally has a loon on it.
Ah.
Apparently, they found one embedded in the ice in Raleigh. And Ryan Smith, the Oiler forward, chipped it and dug it out of the ice. So there's a little bit more intrigue to the series than we thought there was going to be, too.
So supposedly a loony embedded in the ice is good luck for somebody.
Yes, and it's bad luck to have loonies embedded in, like, the loge because they can misbehave.
The National Hockey League announced this week that the NHL is drug-free, and then Dick Pound announced that the people who made that announcement are full of baloney. Who's right?
I'm just tired. I mean, I don't know who's right about this, but Dick Pound has become a reckless nuisance, and he should be reined in, and he should not be paid attention to.
This week, minor league hockey saw a team announce that it will not compete next season for a unique reason, at least as far as I know. Tell us about the Danbury Trashers.
First of all, would you play for the Trashers? Second of all, the owner is a guy named James Galante, and he was arrested on federal racketeering, extortion, witness tampering, and circumventing the league's salary cap. He is apparently all tangled up in a federal organized crime operation, and the federal authorities are saying that the hockey players and their wives had no-show jobs with the owner's garbage company,
which
allowed him to pump $750,000 into salaries when the team's cap was $250,000. This is circumventing the salary cap as money laundering.
Major League Baseball has suspended pitcher Jason Grimsley for 50 games. Does the number of games mean anything in this case? Because the chance that Jason Grimsley will find another job with a Major League team seems exceptionally remote under any circumstances, don't you think?
Well, he's not going to come back. No one's going to hire him. He wasn't very good to start with, and now he's topic A in the ongoing steroid hysteria, or excuse me, human growth hormone hysteria. So, no, they could have suspended him for 300 games and told him to go to the moons of Neptune, as far as I'm concerned.
In other baseball news, the Minnesota Wild hired a colleague of yours as their director of hockey operations. Who knew Peter Gammons was even looking for another job?
Incorrect, my son. It's Chris Snow, the Boston Globe's 24-year-old Red Sox beat writer, who apparently has a real sweet tooth for the puck, eh? And he's going to run the hockey operation at the Minnesota Wild. And he covered the Wild for a while, a couple of years ago, for the Star Tribune in Minneapolis. Who knows? He may turn out to be the new Tex Schramm.
Tiger Woods missed the cut in this week's U.S. Open, marking the first time he has done so in 37 majors as a pro. Is he human after all?
Well, he always has been. This time he just got eaten alive by a wingfoot. He was 3 over after the first 3 holes of his tournament and never really quite caught up.
And finally, Charlie, would you like to... I could barely get the question out. I was going to ask you to do the honors regarding a tip of the only game hat to Catherine Bowler.
Yes, the 14-year-old who just finished her freshman year at Francis Howell High School in Missouri is now the Patsy Montana Yodeling Competition Champion, for which I would point out you have to yodel for 3 days. Not continuously, I don't believe.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
Not all the email that comes to Only a Game responds directly to what's been on the program. Sometimes we just serve as a kind of clearinghouse for sports-related gripes. This explains why Alan Amatspaich, who hears the program on KMOW in St. Louis, wrote as follows. About the U.S. nil, Czech Republic 3. Fire the coach, disown him forever, and pressure the players. No food or water if you lose, or even worse, tell them illegal aliens will replace them. On a serious note, still a hard fan of the U.S. team, I hope they bring their game against Italy. My playful suggestion last week that some of the offsides calls and lack of same when Germany played Costa Rica were a little on the arbitrary side encouraged Errol Wright of Dorchester, Massachusetts, to characterize that comment as, quote, wrong and a disservice to those trying to learn the game. Shame on you, Mr. Wright wrote. In his story last week about Iranian soccer fans in Southern California, Ken Shulman identified the language those fans were speaking as Farsi. One irate listener called to say he should have called the language and culture of Iran Persian and characterized the use of the term Farsi as ignorant and disgusting. Though Farsi is a common and accepted transliteration of the word for the language in Persian, and though some Iranian authorities have encouraged the use of the word, some Iranians feel the term ignores their heritage, culture, and history. For the record, Mr. Shulman used the term Persian when referring to Iranian culture in Los Angeles. Don Adler, a WBUR listener, emailed to suggest that I should provide a list of my favorite sports-related books on our website. Good idea, and I'll do that, and I'll encourage the Only a Game staff to do the same. We invite you to send us your candidates for said list. Finally, my story about Mary Ruhutina, the high school tennis player who went undefeated for over 3 years and whose family escaped the war in Bosnia when Mary was 4 years old, prompted this call to the listener line.
Hi, my name is Steve Schlossman. I'm just calling because I caught the tail end of Only a Game, and I just the metaphor that Mr. Littlefield used was so wonderful, packed his family into the little car and put a war in the rearview mirror. I thought was as good a lyrical phrase as I guess I'm used to hearing him say.
You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can also reach us through our website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu, and our mailing address is onlyagame, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Last Saturday morning, I was at work at Bad Abbott's, a pub in Quincy, Massachusetts, outside of which hung a bright banner proclaiming that every World Cup game would be on the half-dozen TVs inside. The 9 a.m. start made it a tough assignment, but somebody had to do it. To the dismay of the fans wearing the English team's jerseys, at halftime the tally was only 1-0, and England's lone goal had come when a Beckham drive bounced off the head of an unfortunate Paraguayan. Still, Chris Teague, an Englishman now living in Norwood, Massachusetts, was able to manage some optimism.
This is probably their best squad for the last, like, 20 years. So they definitely got the speed up front. They got the, you know, the height up front, you know, Peter Crouch today. So, you know, that's going to be their game plan, I think, going forward.
As it turned out, England didn't go forward consistently enough to score again, and the game ended 1-0. Peter Crouch, the 6'7" forward, was discouraged by pesky Paraguayans, and lots of the English fans gathered at Bad Abbott's were frustrated by coach Sven-Goran Eriksson's decision to keep Wayne Rooney, who is trying to come back from a broken foot, out of the match. Still, a W is a W. Among those holding that line midweek was Paul Mariner.
The first game in the World Cup is so vital that you get off to a flyer, you get off to those 3 points. And it doesn't matter after the event how those points are come by.
Toward the end of an 11-year career, Mariner, now a coach with Major League Soccer's New England Revolution, played for England in the 82 World Cup in Barcelona.
You know, it's nice to play well, of course, but they got the 3 points. It's not the easiest of games, you know, they're blaming the heat, the humidity, all these things that we English people blame when we don't perform particularly well.
Mariner was optimistic about England's chances because he regards this team as more versatile than its predecessors. Whereas previous English sides have relied on the long ball and conditioning, Beckham, Lampard, Gerrard et al. Seem more capable of varying the pace of the game. But Mariner said Wayne Rooney's return seemed crucial.
He is such a huge player for the national team. You've got to compare him to for Ronaldinho for Brazil, while Rooney for England. And if he comes back, it's going to be a massive boost for the squad, a massive boost for the support. And then I think they can really, you know, shake the tree and do well.
The fans gathered in the Phoenix Landing Pub in Cambridge, Massachusetts for England's second game on Thursday afternoon felt the same way about Wayne Rooney. They began a song urging him to stick one in for England while Rooney was still on the bench. On the other hand, at halftime in this game, which found England and Trinidad Tobago both scoreless, an Englishman who identified himself as Steve from London demonstrated that the notorious English pessimism lives.
The last game wasn't a great performance, and I'm pretty disappointed with the team so far.
But you're still smiling.
I'm still smiling. It's England, so we're behind the team 100%, and yeah, we're drinking, and it's gone 12 o'clock, so we're allowed to drink.
For the record, a number of the lads in the English jerseys had given themselves permission to drink for the game between Ecuador and Costa Rica, which began at 9 in the morning. In any case, Gavin, a Nottingham Forest fan, was slightly less pessimistic than Steve. Like Paul Mariner, Gavin yearned for Wayne Rooney's first appearance in the tournament.
Yeah, I think we'll be all right. I think we've played all right, and they're just defending, so it's a matter of time. Stick with the same plan. I don't think we're doing anything wrong. We created the chances. We just need someone other than Crouch on the end of them, and then we'll be all right. I don't think Crouch will score. I think they'll bring Rooney on with a bit to go, and I think it'll liven it all up.
Gavin was half right. With 25 minutes remaining, Wayne Rooney did enter the game, to the delight of almost everybody at Phoenix Landing. But in the 83rd minute, it was the much-maligned Mr. Crouch who stretched over the Trinidad-Tobago defense and headed one in for England. During injury time, Stephen Gerrard added a goal. England, as they say, were through. Outside the pub, a young woman named Patty, who described herself as English by marriage, was relieved.
It's a very good result. I can rest easy tonight. My husband's not going to be screaming.
But you must have been worried before the 83rd minute.
I'm worried all the time.
Like Patty, some of the scores of fans wearing English jerseys were relieved. Others were elated and determined to remain so. Ironically, Kevin Trainer, the man who manages the place where so many fans were at least temporarily so happy, was thoroughly displeased with the day's result.
Well, being from Ireland and England being the enemy for such a long time, we sort of adopt an ABE thing for the games, anyone but England. So,
is there a sizable ABE crowd in there as we speak?
There's a few of them hiding in the back. No, not today. They're pretty outnumbered by English supporters today.
As they will continue to be, as long as England's team survives, Ireland having failed to qualify for the World Cup final this time around. So what does a fellow like Kevin Trainer do? Simple, he says.
We've adopted the Ivory Coast. We've just had to switch the Irish flags backwards, and that's the same flag as ours. So we have to grab on to something, and that's all we can grab on to.
Unhappily for Mr. Trainer, having lost to Argentina Saturday, Ivory Coast fell to the Netherlands and out of the tournament yesterday, meaning the anyone but England crowd will next be supporting either Germany or Ecuador in the round of 16. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Simon Wood, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about Full Swing, view a photo gallery of my excellent England-Trinidad-Tobago adventure, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from soccer fan Fred Delafano.
I'd say one and a half eyes are on the screen because England's playing.
Football Fred had his other half eye on his beer, and no eyes left for his date. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities. WKKF.org, the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. PewTrusts.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, continuing support of individual creativity with the announcement of new MacArthur Fellows September 20th. This is NPR, National Public.